Welcome back to the Bonfire Podcast, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with those closest to the fight game. I am your host, longtime MMA journalist and MMA junkie senior reporter, Mike Bond. And we've got a good one for you today, folks. And there is no time to waste. Lots to discuss. If you're listening to the show, you probably saw Dana White's major news drop on Tuesday and aware by now that Islam Makhachev has vacated his UFC lightweight championship to move to the welterweight division. That makes way for Ilya Topuria to fight Charles Oliveira for the vacant belt in the UFC 317 main event on June 28th. The other bit of major news, we get the UFC 319 headliner on August 16th in Chicago. Dricus du Plessis putting the belt on the line against Khamzat Chimaev, one of the most anticipated fights of the summer. Cannot wait for it. And joining me to sort through all this news, plus rank the all-time UFC welterweight champions in the wake of Jack Della Maddalena dethroning Bilal Muhammad at UFC 315, will be none other than the great Luke Thomas. Had a lot of fun with Luke on the first few appearances on the show, ranking various things, and we're here to do it again, plus talk about all this big news. What a time for the welterweight division right now. Make sure to throw the show a like, a subscription, a follow, a comment, whatever you can do to offer your support. It helps a lot, and appreciate anyone who's doing so. We will take a quick break and be right back with Luke Thomas. We are back here on the Bonfire once again with Luke Thomas, and what a timely appearance, Luke. You know, you're supposed to do this earlier in the week, but I think your personal schedule and maybe the MMA gods work together a little bit on this one. We got the big news drop on Tuesday. How are you doing, first of all?
Doing quite well. And again, I have to apologize to Mike. We were supposed to do this earlier, and I had to send him 15 different text messages asking for 75 different kinds of delays, but here we are. And you're right. To that point, it actually worked out okay because we got hit with a barrage of pretty big news last night, so it's pretty interesting.
For sure. And yeah, I mean, the main thing I wanted to have you on for was obviously reflect on Jack Della Maddalena's win, and then we were going to rank, you know, the all-time welterweight champions. And I think that even gets more focus on it now that we seemingly have our next welterweight title fight, not a date and location for Islam Makhachev yet, but he has vacated the belt. I guess, I don't know, your degree of surprise or shock and the way this ultimately unfolded, because we've been talking about it for months. Would Islam vacate? Would it be an interim fight for Ilya Topuria if they didn't fight each other? What's your stance now that you've had a night to sleep on how everything got announced last night?
I mean, on some level, the announcements last night were obviously quite big because it's International Fight Week headliner. They obviously announced the headliner for August. We knew what the headliner was already for July. So to me, like, one of the big takeaways from the entirety of the announcements was that, wow, the UFC summer, if, you know, knock on wood, fingers crossed, if it holds, is going to be electric, at least insofar as the main events are concerned. I guess we'll see how the cards go ultimately. Also, that Abu Dhabi card in July is already got two great fights on it, including, not limited to, the main event and the Shara Bullet fight that got added yesterday. So in that sense, I was like, oof, this looks really, really good. I'm pretty excited about that. But I didn't have necessarily a big, like, huge reaction because so much of this had been telegraphed. We kind of had a pretty clear idea. Dana White, not really dispelling it before the fights, being like, hey, if depending on the results of UFC 315, that's going to affect what Islam does or doesn't do. And sure enough, it followed right along the lines of that. I guess we didn't know exactly if Charles Oliveira was going to be the dance partner. I think there are some folks who were kind of pushing for a Saryukian fight, but I didn't think that was the right call. I think Charles actually is the better call ultimately. I love that fight. By the way, I don't know how much longer Islam is going to compete, but assuming we get, let's say, two or even three welterweight fights, I find the notion of him going up to welterweight very, very exciting. You do lose the Ilya-Islam fight, which to me is probably the best fight that the UFC could make, especially across weight classes in that way, you know? Mm-hmm. But the notion of getting Islam for, again, assuming we get two or three of those at 170, to me, at this moment in time for 170, is absolutely incredible. And then lastly, the thing I would say is, we didn't really get to it, but, you know, Khamzat and DDP, this is one of the best, like, I should say, one of the most, you just know that fight is going to be bananas. you just know. And also what I would say is, you know, Islam was obviously stationed at 155, but kind of wanted to go to 170. 170 him versus Jack Dale is great. And now Topuria moving up 55 him versus Charles Oliveira is great. And I know that initially Khamzat was a 170-er, but he's been at 185 at least for some time now. He got a very important win at 170 in his last contest, or 185, excuse me, in his last contest, which I think the point I'm trying to make is that one's a little bit more just homegrown champion who'd been sitting a post, guy working his way through the contendership queue, again, with some exception here or there. I just think that's one of the best fights UFC can make. Certainly one of the most like electric, insane fights that they could make. A lot to be happy about, I think, by yesterday's announcements.
Yeah, it was great. The summer schedule is looking amazing. I'll get into DDP and Khamzat in a couple, but as far as, you know, the fight between Ilya and Islam not happening, it's interesting, right? The last time I had you on, we did our fighter value lists, and we both had Islam and Ilya at 1 and 2, and this was 2 days before Ilya announced he was vacating the title. We did that show, and we talked about whether it would be in the best interest to make that fight or keep them as two separate entities, and this is what we said. I'll show you the clip. You had the book, do you put Ilya versus Islam, or do you think, given we have them at our 1 and 2, is that either a good move because we have them 1 and 2, that would be a massive fight for the sport, or do you keep those two in their lane and you try to use 1 and 2 as your, you know, two independent objects that could be built around?
I would keep them separate, but I just don't know if there is market demand for that, you know. Yeah. I think there's demand to get them together and, you know, follow the money. Yep. That seems to dictate everything.
So thoughts on that now? Is it the right call to keep these two apart? Or, you know, like I'd heard that that's kind of what the UFC preferred because, you know, everyone talks about the star problem, these type of things. These two guys are obviously two big figures.
I'm of the belief that just given where we are now, I'm not... Okay, again, the single best fight they could have made is that one. Mm-hmm. But I really feel like people being like, oh, it's a gigantic trade-off to now get what we're getting with UFC 317 and ultimately where Islam ends up fighting Jack De La Maddalena. I don't think that's a tremendous downgrade. I really don't. I don't think any of those fights are as big as the one that aforementioned, but I think they're all really, really good. And Ilya can still achieve a significant amount with a win at 317. And either Islam or JDM can achieve quite a bit. Now, obviously, you run a risk if Islam goes up there and gets waxed because that creates some issues. But I don't think he'll get waxed, win or lose. I don't know. I was never one of these guys that was like, okay, they got to make Ilya versus Islam at all costs. I recognize the value that I saw what the fans were saying. And there was true demand for it. But I'm just telling you personally, like, I'm pretty excited about what they got, and I don't think it's a tremendous trade-off or a downgrade.
Yeah, I agree as well. I talked to Ali Abdelaziz, Islam's manager, last night, like right after this news dropped. And of course, you know, everyone's wondering, why did he vacate the belt, right? He put out that tweet the day before UFC 315 saying, like, looking forward to this main event. He'll determine what's next for me, but I'm not vacating the title. But here we are. He did vacate it. Do you feel he vacated it, or did the UFC force this? And was he technically stripped? I tried to ask Ali like a few times and he kind of danced around the question, but like he did say this was mutual between the UFC and Islam, and Islam is okay leaving, you know, that belt and that legacy behind. But I always felt he wanted like that champ moment Conor McGregor, Daniel Cormier, Amanda Nunes had, where both belts are on the shoulder. And, you know, he at least said he's still going to carry around that lightweight belt. He's still the champion, but technically he is not.
Yeah. I mean, what fighter gives up hardware if they don't have to? Yeah. Like, that's just not a thing. That just doesn't exist. You know, they give up hardware when they're done. They give up hardware when they have to, they get stripped. They give up hardware when they're no longer interested in even bothering with something. They don't give up hardware like, oh, I felt it was in the best interest of other people. Like, they don't, you know, that's not typically a relevant concern. So I think that the UFC probably leaned on him for it. And, you know, there's a trade to be made. You can go to 170, you can get a second title, you can even parade the two at the same time. But, you know, technically speaking, we're not going to allow you to have both simultaneously. And we kind of understand why, right? It just gums up the works. And it's very, dude, it's like one thing if you're defending a weight class like 10 pounds apart, even that is extremely difficult to do. But then to do it when you're 15, it's already kind of hard for you to make the 55. And then you're going to go back and forth. And if you can even manage that and what it does to your body, it's just not realistic. So like, I'm not even like saying I disagree with the UFC's logic here, but I don't think it was mutual. The one thing I will say though is, you know, it's just very funny to watch them be like, okay, you know, we got to make sure that these titles get defended on time. Meanwhile, John Jones is on the moon, I guess, or, you know, just
in
doing
Thailand. He's on the back of a moped is where he is.
20,000 leagues under the sea. I don't know. Just doing nothing. And he gets to ride. I grant it's a different set of circumstances, but it's just kind of funny to watch. In general, though, I think the UFC in leaning on him made the right call.
Yeah, is this a line in the sand moment too? Because like I think there was a report that came out before UFC 311 in January being like UFC is done with the champ era. And I think Dana got asked about it at that press conference. And he kind of gave, you know, like a nonchalant answer or noncommittal. But we're seeing the evidence here, right? Like they needed Ilya Topuria to move on from his belt because they needed a main event for Miami. I assume they want Islam to move on because they need a main event for International Fight Week. Is this now the thing that just champ realities of having that moment of two belts are a thing of the past now?
It has to be. And again, like just understanding the UFC's business model and the way in which they work, and you know, you're on the front lines of this, I think you're keenly aware, like one of the most important things for them, if not the most important thing, is the ability to consistently deliver events on a timely schedule without significant interruption, right? And of course, having a crown jewel at the top of that card, particularly for their pay-per-view product, is critical, non-negotiable. They have to have it. And so if guys have multiple titles, it's a little different if you're talking like Amanda Nunes, 135, 145. That's a separate case. But typically speaking, you know, someone having two titles at once and, you know, these guys are only fighting two for champions. I mean, I don't know what the math on this is, Mike, but like, you know, I would say that it's not how many times in the history of UFC has a champion defended a title three times in a calendar year? Of course, it has happened, but it's not six. The most... Yeah, it's not, again, it's like, a handful of times. It's very, very difficult to do. So you're going to have two of those at once. Like, that's really, 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 really hard to do. It just doesn't make a lot of sense just given the way their business model works. So, you know, if the fighters want to do something about it, they can figure that out. But the UFC rules the roost and it's better for their business to keep things moving. And that's what's going to be.
Yeah, instances of three title defenses in 1 year. I have them here for you. Frank Shamrock in 1998, Tito Ortiz.
So not even really modern era. Okay,
there's a couple modern era. Tito Ortiz 2001, Matt Hughes 2002, Chuck Liddell 2006, Demetrius Johnson 2013, Kamaru Usman 2021, and Alex Pereira 2024.
So, yeah, and Pereira did all of those like banged up, short notice. You know what I mean? And so you'll see that. You'll absolutely see. And also, Poatan, one of the most important fighters for the UFC. Kamaru, we'll talk about him in just a minute. Arguably the best of, you know, but certainly top three welterweight of all time. And Demetrius, one of the very best to ever do it. Certainly the best at flyweight ever. You know, and Frank Shamrock, Tito, all the guys you mentioned, they're all like, even pre-modern era, it's not for the faint of heart. It's a very rare thing. I get why UFC is not in favor of it.
Yeah, I would have just liked it, like, give Islam that for one night, right? Like, he wins it, you give him the chance for the photos, and then, you know, you talk to him the next week and say, what's your decision? Are you staying at 170 and keeping this belt and vacating lightweight, or are you going back and vacating this 170 belt, assuming he wins? I felt that would have been the rightful way to do it, but, you know, then you say, like, the moment him and Jack fight, that's when he decides, all that little thing they do, but I guess that was not meant to be for this particular scenario. Is this kind of for the best for Islam though now, right? Like not having that idea of like, I still have this 155 belt. He can fully commit his body to the move up and all that kind of stuff. Probably some value in that too. Not having, I might have to make 155 again in the next 8 to 12 months, having that linger in your mind.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's good. It's no way to say that it's bad, but we should talk about some of the downsides. So the positive side for Islam, obviously, as you indicated, the weight cut's going to be just a 15 extra pounds is a lifeline for him at this stage in his career. I mean, that's just a huge amount of goodwill, I think, that will do him. So certainly that is great. And also, you know, the ability to capture a title in the second weight class puts him in a degree of MMA immortality. That's all tremendous. And again, the last part I'm going to say is you've got Buckley, Gary, you've got Shavkat, you've got Brady, you've got Jack. I mean, dude, welterweight is on fire right now. And now you're going to add the freaking number one pound for pound fighter in the world to that. This is what I mean when people are like, yeah, if Islam fights once and calls it a day at 170 and takes like an early exit, like a la Habib, that won't be my favorite. But if he sticks around for a little bit, dude, you're just talking about magic at 170 right now, a very, very rare moment to be excited about. I will say, you know, kind of an anticlimactic end to the reign of Islam Makhachev, the top pound-for-pound fighter in the sport. He had to fight Volk twice, you know, quite literally a blown-up featherweight. You know, Hanato Moicano was his last win, which was not his fault, and none of that's his fault, but it was a short-notice fight, and that's another, well, former, I should say, went blown up because he, I think, naturally moved to 55, but a former one of those. You know, there's a bunch of 45ers that he that ended up moving to 55 that ended up being the bulk of his title reign. And so to me, it's like, you know, the pound for pound best guy in the sport, you got a lot of respect for him. I'm excited about what it means for welterweight, but it does feel, I mean, personally speaking, everyone's going to feel a little bit different. It feels a little anticlimactic to me to like that his reign just comes to a close like this. And
yeah, via a Dana White Instagram live.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And just also like, you know, if he had ended on the Poirier fight, again, a former featherweight who couldn't make featherweight now if his life depended on it, but I'm just talking about the reign of what that meant. You know, maybe that would have felt a little bit better because that was a surprisingly competitive fight and it had a, you know, a dramatic end. Moicano, you know, is a good fighter. He's a very good fighter, but he got run over by the best guy in the sport. It just, and then we just call it a day like that. And then it's this handing the title back, you know, we've seen it over the years, Mike, when you hand a title back administratively, it just doesn't mean the same thing. It just doesn't. It cannot mean the same thing. It's not a torch passing in that same way. And so, you know, credit to Islam for how great he has become. And I respect the hell out of him. But and I'm excited about the future. But I do feel a little like, I don't know, like almost like that's it at 55. Like that's all that it was. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a weird one because, like, you know, everyone's going to say, and we saw Ilya saying, like, he ran for me, blah, blah, blah. There's fans that want that fight. And, you know, I understand, like, 10 years from now, people aren't really going to think about this particular moment, especially if Islam wins the belt, maybe defends it a few times at welterweight. And especially if Ilya loses, right? Like, then this whole conversation completely goes away. If it's to Charles, he was, you know, never meant to be in that regard. But, yeah, you think when all is said and done, like, are we going to... Is the narrative going to be Islam left a big challenge behind at lightweight in the form of Ilya Topuria, or does that only happen if he defends the title 3-4 times and, you know, builds his legacy up at 55 before then?
That's a good question. It definitely depends on their success, both of them, because obviously if Ilya goes and does great things and then Islam gets waxed at 70 and now he gets his chin cracked and now you're not even the same when you come back to 55, assuming that's what he does, no. That would be bad. That would be bad. Yeah, I mean, you know, you got pound for pound number one versus pound for pound number two in the sport, and they couldn't make that fight. But of course, they made that fight previously when it was Volk and Islam, and it's like, you know, people misremember that fight too. They always think about, oh, the second one Volk took on short notice and then he got smoked. But in the first one, people are like, oh, he had Islam on the ropes. Well, Islam kind of faded down the stretch in that fight due to the weight cut and everything. That fight is not nearly as competitive as folks like to remember that it was. I've watched it several times back, and Islam was clearly the better guy in that fight. So
I thought so too. Yet they still kept Volk at number one pound for pound after he lost that fight.
It's insane. Yeah, it's insane. Total disrespect. That's the other part too. Like the one kind of thing is like Islam is the protege of Habib, but he does not, like, Habib commanded a degree of respect during his run that I think has eluded Islam to a degree. And you're asking a different kind of question, but I just feel like we're all kind of waiting, not for Islam to prove that he's great, but for that one big, huge rivalry fight that could really finally put to bed any kind of lingering questions about, is this the guy who just beat a blown up featherweights? Is this the guy who ran when, which I don't agree with, but ran when Ilya came up and blah, blah, blah. You know, these are not necessarily fair questions, but that they exist and that they are circulated kind of means something. So, you know, to answer the question that you had asked, it really all just, there's so many ways that things have to play out a certain way for that reality that you're positing to arrive. And I don't think it's the likeliest one. But again, for as many great things are as achievable for him at 170, maybe the 170 fights will put this all to bed too. You know, maybe if he has some tooth and nail fights, but he has to rise to the occasion and he gets his hand raised, people will be like, wow, man, that really was incredible. I don't know if we'll look back and say we miss it. It's just hard to say. It's hard to say.
and easily we could still get the fight. You know, they both win. Maybe some of this stuff happens. Maybe Ilya Topuria is so freaking good, he cleans out lightweight and we get this fight at 170 and he tries to be a triple champ or something crazy. Who knows? But last thing on this, Luke, when I was talking to Ali last night about, like, you know, the timing for Islam versus Jack, he basically said kind of a thing that we're hearing more and more here. Like, if Jack isn't ready to fight this year, the UFC has promised Islam he is fighting for the welterweight title this year, whether Jack Della Maddalena is ready or not. And he cited, like, the Jamal Hill situation, the Yuri Prohoshka situation, where, like, if the guy isn't ready on UFC's timeline, if he's injured or something like that, I don't have any news of Jack having suffered a serious injury besides, you know, the superficial facial damage in that fight. But that's what he said. Like, Islam is fighting for the belt this year, and if Jack isn't ready, he will be fighting someone else at welterweight. And this is same thing kind of Ilya's team claimed, Tom Aspinall's side. I know it's a very different situation, but saying, like, you know, if John isn't ready, it'll be the next guy. But this seems like the new thing the UFC is promising these fighters in negotiation. Like, you do this, you're fighting for the belt, whether the current champion is ready or not.
What does that mean?
I mean, it sounds like to me he's saying that if Jack isn't ready to defend the title by November, say, or October, whenever they want to do this fight, he's getting stripped and they're going to do Islam versus Sean Brady or Ian Garry or whoever the guy they think makes sense at welterweight.
Really? They're just going to strip Jack like that?
That's what he alluded to. I don't know. It sounds strange to me too, but this is kind of what they're, you know, similar situation to what happened with Islam, right? Like, if the guy doesn't want to do the fight or isn't in position to, they're going to
okay,
go
but,
to the
but
guy.
Jamal Hill had like a serious catastrophic injury.
So did Yuri Prohoshka.
Yeah. Like, they had like, oh yeah, exactly. His was like, I'm going to be out for a year. Yeah, okay, under that circumstance, if Jack is like, you know, again, I saw the cuts and he has swollen eye, but nothing too significant, to the extent that that's all that there is, this is not really an irrelevant conversation. If he has an injury where he's out like 4 months, they would strip him. I'll tell you, like, you know, I know Ali's advocating for his guys, but sure, I just don't believe that. I think, yeah, in those other situations where you have a catastrophic injury where it's simply not even realistic to book you, who knows when you're going to be back exactly. Yeah, they'll move on without you, but I just don't, you know, they're making it out to be like, oh, if he says no to, I'll make something up, November, they'll just pass him by. Yeah, no they won't.
Yeah, so just reiterating what he said, I think it was his point of being like, Islam is fighting for the welterweight title this year. I have no reason to think Jack won't be ready. He's saying in every interview he wants to fight in 4 or 5 months, which might be sooner than the UFC even has him ready to go. So
what's going to be interesting? What's going to be interesting is the opposite, right? So let's say Jack's ready, and then Islam gets injured, and now he's not ready. Now there's a slew of contenders they could pick from here. You could pick Garry. You could pick Rachmanov, you could pick whoever, but the division's going to move forward and it's going to be even more demand at that top. And then when Islam comes back, you're like, oh, well, he'll just slot right in. Probably, but let's imagine that he comes back on a similar timeline to Rachmanov, who was already supposed to have it, and then took on Ian Garry at last minute notice when he didn't necessarily have to kind of rescue that pay-per-view a little bit. They're just going to pass him by. Again, Islam is number one pound for pound, so if anyone gets an exception, it's probably him. I'm just saying, to me, it's much more interesting because of how many contenders are moving up. If Islam isn't ready, that could create some real headaches at 170 about how you figure out that logjam.
Yeah, that'll be interesting for sure. We'll see how that goes. I'm efforting to speak to Islam. Hopefully we can get more clarity on, you know, the vacating the belt and all that stuff, but not sure when that will happen. But I guess last thing before we move on to our rankings here, we spoke of Dricus du Plessis versus Khamzat Chimaev. Obviously, one of the most anticipated fights for me, I think, probably have it number one in the upcoming schedule here. We just confirmed Nassourdine Imabov will be the backup for that fight and weigh in. Nice. So interested where that leaves Kyle Baralho at middleweight, because he's kind of the odd man out now. But this fight, I'm so glad they're doing it in the United States, return to Chicago. This feels like the big platform Dricus du Plessis deserves as well. He's not being tucked away in a pay-per-view that sucks in Australia or Canada.
Yeah. Hey, Canada's having a good moment.
Could use a little work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I'll just say this. I mean, we didn't know, obviously, because of his relationship to, say, Chechen government officials, whether Khamzat was going to be able to get back into the country. And here he is. And, you know, whatever else anyone wants to say about that, it can only boost his star power in the most significant of ways. to compete here in the United States on pay-per-view in a pretty big market in Chicago, Illinois. I'm assuming it's going to be at the United Center. I don't know if they announced the United Center, but okay. And then for to your point about DDP, DDP's been a bit of a road warrior, man. He's been kind of out there, and you know, it would be nice to get him something to take back to South Africa, like to have an event there, but that's just probably not in the cards for UFC. And so putting him in also in the United States in a big market on a big pay-per-view. And again, and one more time, can I be honest with you? Everyone's going to feel a little differently. Okay. I'm like an Ilya Topuria fanboy. This is well established, you know, and I think he's going to send Charles's chin into orbit in June. Okay. All right. I don't think, to me, there's almost no question he becomes champion. Again, Charles is dangerous. Ilya can get a little bit in front of his skis. One never knows, but you know, gun to my head, I'm absolutely going to pick Ilya Topuria. But that main event between Khamzat and DDP, brother, I mean, two cats in a bag.
Good luck breaking that down.
Exactly. Like how you know Chimaev's going to shoot, and you know he's probably going to have the back at some point, maybe even potentially early. But after that, I don't really know what to say. And DDP is a guy who I think a lot of us, me included, have been so wrong about that we had to kind of be like, all right, what are we missing here? And you saw the video, I'm sure, with Israel and Rob sitting down together, being like, just kind of laughing like they couldn't even imagine style would be so effective. And yet it was. And so for that reason, can I be honest with you? I'm actually much more excited about DDP Khamzat than I am even Ilya Topuria versus Charles Oliveira for all of these aforementioned reasons.
Yeah, I think my rankings for the summer pay-per-view is probably Khamzat and DDP one, Poirier and Max second, and then probably Ilya and Charles third, and then Marab and Sean number four. I think that's kind of
That's about
in reverse order here. All right, well, since I did a little ranking there, we'll get into our welterweight rankings here. Luke, asked you to run down a list of the all-time welterweight champions in the wake of Jack Della Maddalena's victory. There has now been 12 in the books. Jack is the 13th. We will see what he can do with his reign. Obviously a big obstacle to start things out for him, but yeah, there's 12 guys who have held that belt over the course of UFC history, undisputed, not interim, in chronological order here. They are Pat Miletich, Carlos Newton, Matt Hughes, BJ Penn, George St. Pierre, Matt Serra, Johnny Hendricks, Robbie Lawler, Tyron Woodley, Kamaru Usman, Leon Edwards, and Bilal Muhammad. So we each did our list here. We'll start at the bottom, Luke. Obviously, I feel like there's two different tiers here kind of to this list. There's the no title defense tier and then the minimum two title defense tier. There's no in between. No one had won and then saw their reign ended. So yeah, I think for me, it was basically just figuring out those bottom five who didn't get a title defense, figuring out how they work, and then sorting it up from there. So did you have a similar challenge there?
So I wouldn't say that was as much my challenge. I think for me, I'll be honest, I think the first five and even six were not that hard for me. Okay. Top half of that list was fairly easy for me anyway.
Yeah.
But the problem that I run into is, one, you don't have like you have the title defense issue. And then the other issue is you have an era issue. And then a lot of these guys were one hitter quitters. Mm-hmm. And in the case of, like, for example, BJ Penn, who had no real welterweight, I mean, I'm not much of a welterweight resume to begin with, really at all, not in any kind of coherent, you know, straightforward way that we would typically understand it. It's hard to know what to make of that. And like, you know, he had two subsequent, and this is not really relevant, but you know, he had two subsequent rematches with Hughes, and obviously he won the third one, and the second one he was doing all right, but then he tore his rib and he lost. And it's like, I just don't know. It's really hard to contextualize to me someone like a Penn, someone like even a Carlos Newton, who's competing in a totally different era, and like what that level of achievement means. Obviously, bulldog choking Pat Miletich is a big deal, but it, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how to rank. I really, really, really struggled with era more than I struggled with achievement outright. But there was plenty to struggle with here. I can be sure about that.
Yeah, and criteria I kind of gave you more or less open, but more so like said to focus on, you know, the manner in which they won the belt and then what they did when they held it. So Yeah, I can. I guess I'll start here. Spoiler alert or revealer. I bookend both my lists with Canadians. So obviously no secret who the number one welterweight of all time is. But number 12, I did have Carlos Newton. I put him at the bottom. Just, yeah, it was a tough one. But as we kind of will get into, I thought he was the guy that, I don't know, just the whole thing didn't really exceed some of the stuff. And I think it was a lot to do with the era thing that you represented.
So for me, if I may, mm-hmm. I had him at 12 initially on my list.
Okay.
I bumped him up a little bit, but I went with Penn. Now, this is a hard one for me to this is what I mean. This was tough.
Yeah.
Because for a couple of reasons. Penn was a dominant lightweight champ for at least a little while. Two, he's for a time anyway, was my favorite fighter ever. Obviously, he fell in hard times.
Yes.
And the other part I mentioned was his resume was all, especially up to that point in 2004, was all over the place. And he ran over Matt Hughes. And that was a huge deal at the time. Please don't misunderstand me. But he only held the title for 100 days or so. He dipped out to K1. And he's fighting Henzo. And, you know, it was just a weird time. And I just don't know really how to contextualize it. Whereas, for me, Newton also beat a legend to win mm-hmm. the title, Bulldog choking Pat Miletich, and obviously Penn beating Hughes, one of two of the top welterweights of all time. But he had a length of a resume before that in that weight class, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he stayed in it for a time afterwards as well. And I was up and down a little bit after that. But I don't know. He had a little bit more of a campaign that I could look to make sense of. Whereas Penn was just Mr. One Night Stand, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So
a little hard to say.
There was a couple One Night Stand guys on here. I had Penn a little higher. I'll reveal him in a few moments here. But yeah, I think your thinking was pretty similar there. I mean, these guys are tough to distinguish, but I do think the moment of him coming up and the way he beat Matt Hughes in that first fight, like that was obviously very significant at the time in itself. No one really saw that coming. So yeah, I think he gets a few more brownie points for me for that. Okay, who did you have at 11 then?
Carlos Newton.
Okay.
So Newton. So that I in that sense, Newton and I mean, this is about where he belongs, kind of mm-hmm. at that bottom, which seems unfair. Like if you saw Carlos Newton come up at the time, and I remember, like, this is gonna sound kind of crazy, but when he first came up, I remember like they were talking about him like as this young Canadian guy who was really well rounded. Dude, he was fucking yoked. Like he was yoked at a time when you still had Hoist Gracie. Then there were some other guys at the time too, obviously, but I just remember Carlos Newton was like a physically imposing kind of presence. Mm-hmm. And he had that, you know, martial arts Bushido, and he would do the whole Hadouken thing and the whole. But in terms of his ranking, you know, he was really up and down for long stretches of his career, especially after this win over Pat Miletich. And the win against Pat was really, really great. But there wasn't a lot to be built on after that, obviously. And, you know, so I respect what he did. He's a Canadian MMA pioneer, no question about it. But I have to keep him kind of low on the list for this reason. It just wasn't enough to put him higher.
Yeah, and a weird way for him to lose the belt as well, with the infamous triangle choke slam moment and all that.
Yeah,
stuff. You can argue he should have got the title defense over Matt.
You can. I mean, again, for folks who don't know the story, he slams Hughes. They both went out. Mm-hmm. Hughes slammed him. They both go out, but the referee only saw Carlos Newton was out. And when the triangle choke lets go, you could see Matt wobble for a second and then come to, you know, one of those things where, I mean, a different referee could have seen it. We'd have a different conversation, but that's the way it went. And here we are.
Yeah, here we are indeed. Okay, for my number 11, I had Johnny Hendricks. His is such a weird case, right? Because if he gets the decision over George St. Pierre that many people believe he won, we're having a completely different conversation right now. But of course, that is not a title win on his record. And then he comes back and has, you know, a debatable decision over Robbie Lawler and then loses it in the rematch. So like, and then of course the fall off after that is insane for Johnny Hendricks. You would have thought he would have been one of the guys higher on this list, maybe when he was in his prime, but here he is occupying very much near the bottom of my list. And yeah, it's, I wish I could give him more points for the close GSP fight, but I don't know, just given the fall off after, maybe it's the best for everyone's legacy that he didn't get the win that night.
I've watched that fight now a few times back. I thought he beat GSP. Yeah, I thought he did. I mean, he didn't, obviously, right? We're talking about so many ways in which fights go by officiating, but jobbed is not the right word, but you were there that night, right? When GSP's face was clobbered. Yeah. I'd never seen it. You know, there's times, man, where I've covered guys' fights and, or even just watching from afar. Mm-hmm. And there was one night that's always stands out to me. Let me give you an example. So like, I'd never seen GSP's face like this. Never, yeah. Never in a million years. And not since, obviously he didn't have much action after that, but you get the point. The first time I'd really ever seen, I mean, I'd seen BJ lose before, but the Nick Diaz fight was the one where I saw him physically bruised in a way that I'd never seen before. Yeah. I'd never seen
leather before that.
People don't understand this. He had a rock chin and was hard to hurt, like in terms of cutting his skin, whereas like Fedor is one of these guys where like you just blow on him and his face lights up like he fought in BKFC or something. And that night when Hendricks did that to GSP, I was like, holy shit, man. That was a memorable night. GSP gutted it out, but that was a tough one.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so number 10, I'll go back to back here. I had BJ Penn at 10 there, so he just like, right on the cusp. Again, the way he beat Matt Hughes just gave him a little more value than Johnny Hendricks winning the title by a close decision there against Robbie Lawler. Who did you have at 10?
I have Hendricks. I have Hendricks there for many of the same reasons. I had to put him a little higher than some of these guys. And the reason why is because, Newton kind of represents something more important for the welterweight division, if I'm being honest. But Hendricks' run to the title in the modern era was a force of nature. And I can contextualize the significance of that achievement a little bit more readily. To your point, obviously there was not much of a campaign afterwards, but that alone to me, it was so dominant. I mean, dude, he blew like if John Fitch had been wearing shoes when he took that punch, he would have knocked him straight out of his shoes. You know what I mean? Yeah, like a cartoon.
It was a skid mark in the octagon.
Yeah. Like it was, I mean, it was like something you watch out of an Avengers movie. And, Fitch was still a viable fighter at that time. That was an impressive moment in time. So there wasn't enough afterwards to rank him much higher for all the things that you bring up, but I've got Hendricks at 10. I think that's the right call.
Yeah, for sure. Who else did he skid across the octagon? He did like two in a row there, didn't he? There
were,
like,
was it Martin Kampman was one of them?
I believe so. I'm looking at the record now. Yeah, correct. It was Martin Kampman. Yeah, 46 seconds.
Okay. And by the way, people don't respect that, but like anybody who was around for Martin Kampman's run, Martin Kampman was a good fighter. And you'd be like, oh, he lost to Diego Sanchez. No, he didn't. The judges said he did. Go watch that fight. Diego was punching nothing but air for the vast majority of that fight. Martin Kampman won that contest. And Martin Kampman was the first guy to really level up Team Alpha Male. Martin Kampman was a good fighter. So that's a nice win that he got there. Trust me.
Yeah, that's a hell of a stretch for him. I mean, John Fitch knockout, Josh Koscheck split decision, Martin Kampman knockout, and then Carlos Condit. So yeah, he had a nice run there, but yeah, not enough to elevate him past 10 on my list, and apparently not on yours either. So yep. You go back to back here, Luke. Who is your number 9? I'm curious on this one.
Oh, this was okay. This is the part that's really tough. This was I don't know what to say about this. So, I struggled here.
I flip flopped this one a few times too.
Okay, so ultimately, in the end, I'm going to go with Matt Serra at 9.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm going with him and not some other ones is obviously the win over GSP was incredible. I remember exactly do you remember where you were when that fight happened?
Yes, I was at a friend's place in Vancouver in his basement with a bunch of my high school friends, probably drinking beers underage.
I was at Hard Times Cafe in Fredericksburg, Virginia. That's where I was. I'll never forget that. I had a girlfriend at the time. I was visiting her and we were watching the fights and, I was telling everyone, because I was one of these, still am a completely arrogant piece of shit, but was telling everyone around me, this guy barely beat Chris Lytle to get this. I mean, St. Pierre is going to wax this fucking guy.
Of course, yeah.
And then That's not what happened. And that is just one of the most monumental wins, certainly upsets in UFC history. You cannot overstate how big it was. And for folks who've never gone back and reviewed it, St. Pierre tapped to strikes in that fight. Yeah. There's a lot of people who don't seem to realize that. And Sarah obviously did have some decoration before that, you know, as an American black belt in jiu-jitsu and had some achievements that obviously Penn was the apex predator in that sense, but Sarah was a big achiever. And had some nice wins to that part. But, like, I cannot overstate this to you. Like, you know, this was the guy that got sent to, or he got beaten by a spinning back fist from Shoni Carter. You know, if you guys don't remember who Mr. International was, yeah, Mr. International. Like, you know, Shoni Carter was a good fighter too, but just not one of these names that's just going to stand the test of time. And dude, he fucking stopped Matt Serra. And it's like, and then the Chris Lytle fight kind of sucked for him to get in there. And, but he just came alive in that fight. And I thought his campaign afterwards, actually, even though, you know, Sarah got lost the title pretty quickly, but, you know, the fights against Frank Trigg, for example, where he just showed all he, St. Pierre forced Matt Sarah to level up. And remember, there was an injury to St. Pierre. And so yeah. There was actually like, oh, Matt Sarah ended up telling the world it was actually like a back-to-back camp that he ended up having. And all that extra sparring, all that extra rounds, he turned a corner. He became a different fighter after that point. And not enough to beat St. Pierre in the rematch, obviously, but he became a really good one. But, you know, there's enough of these gaps in that campaign. There's enough of these problems. And the fact that there's not much after that in terms of a title reign that I couldn't put him much higher. But the fact that he had a no bullshit, if you flip a coin 100 times on average, you know, it's going to be at 50 times heads, 50 times tails, right? But let's imagine something a little bit different. Imagine you have a scenario where the chance of something happening is 1%. So you have 100 scenarios, 99 times.
Mavericks winning number one in the NBA draft lottery.
Hey, don't you fucking bring this up to me. Dude, the Wizards have gone down in terms of what they could have done 11 times. 11 times. Okay. But the point I'm trying to make is if you have a situation where it's 99% X and then 1% Y, people sometimes think in their minds, oh, the first 99 will be X and then the last one will be Y. But from a probability standpoint, it could happen that the first time is Y and then the subsequent 99 times are X. And I think it's exactly what you got here, which I'm trying to say in that respect, it wasn't a fluke. Yeah, St. Pierre was better. Clearly he was better, but he wasn't better that night. And you're not going to be better every night. And so there was like nothing bullshit about that win. So I have to give him a big spot here as a consequence, but couldn't go any higher due to all the other issues.
Sure. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I had him slightly higher. I'll reveal in a second, but I think everything you said there, great. I mean, he won the freaking season of the Ultimate Fighter, the comeback season. Like, if you try to give a modern fan context, they just did this on the Ultimate Fighter 2 years ago with like a comeback season. Imagine Kurt Holobow winning that season of the Ultimate Fighter, being given a title shot and then beating Islam Makhachev. Like, that is, that's, I know, right. GSP hadn't, like, that was his first title reign. He hadn't really defended it. He was still kind of immature, he'll say, but essentially that is like almost the equivalent. And how insane would that
be? Or beating Ilya or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Any of these guys, it's absolutely ridiculous what he pulled off that night. And yeah, you got to give him insane points for what I still believe is the biggest upset in UFC history to this day. So yeah, Matt Serra, full respect. I'll give him his spot in a second, but number nine on my list, I did put Bilal Muhammad. No title defenses there. His title win over Leon, not the most exciting thing in the world, even though a very good performance on the night under the circumstances. You got to give him his points for the run he made up to the belt, all that kind of stuff. Maybe in a fairer world, he wins it a year earlier and, you know, maybe has a little less mileage, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe he gets a defense there. But yeah, I just couldn't put Bilal too much higher after, you know, winning the belts by decision, not amazing, and then losing it by decision in a good fight. But I did think he got bested that night.
If I may,
yep,
I have Bilal at 8.
Okay.
And the reason why is you might be like, well, again, Sarah's got one victory in a way that Bilal just doesn't. And so I really struggled with where to put them for that reason. The thing that gives me, puts Bilal a little bit ahead of it for me was the campaign to get there is just so much more extensive in that weight class. Now we're asking like, who's the best champion? And so how do you rank guys who don't have any title defenses? You know what I mean? Like, it's just very, very difficult to do. But because Muhammad had like such a great win streak, and you know, you could say what you want about the Gilbert Burns win, but the Sean Brady win is just no bullshit whatsoever. And that's a really, that one is going to age real well, I think. Mm-hmm. I had to go a little bit of a lean, but like, how do you match up all of that against arguably the greatest upset of all time? And I really, really struggled. So I had him to this point. I had them 8 and 9 going back and back and back and back. I kind of just gave Bilal a little bit of a boost because I think what you do to get to the title really matters to me. Mm-hmm. And different era, but he did a lot to get there, and I have to put some respect on that.
Yep, totally fair. Okay, so that's the kind of the no title defense portion here. So interested to see where we go. Yeah, I had Matt Serra, I think I said, at number 8, so just above Bilal. So just slight switching here on our list. Number 7, as we get into people who did achieve title defenses, I have Leon Edwards. Again, like, you know, the way he won the title is good as anyone could ever ask for it. But you could make an argument, you know, he lost the third Usman fight. It was very close, especially with the point deduction. And then the Colby Covington fight was completely uninspired, and then as was his title loss. So again, he made a nice run up to the top, but yeah, I don't think Leon Edwards will be known as having a memorable title reign.
Yeah, so I mean, to me, these are the two separate lists part here. Mm-hmm. Right, so now yeah. We're talking about guys where you're trying to measure like what it means for through these title defenses versus the ones who are competing in different eras and had no title defenses. Really, really quite difficult to parse. Again, and if someone's going to look at some of the ways I picked this and be like, hey, this one should have been higher. Yeah, probably. These are hard things to figure out. I had Leon at 7 as well. Mm-hmm. I think of the guys who have title defenses, his to me is the least remarkable. Now, of course, we're talking about a high level of achievement no matter what. But in that group, he to me firmly sits at the bottom for all the reasons you articulated. The way in which he got the title, incredible. And then defending it, incredible. But the Colby Covington thing didn't mean much to me. And then obviously he got waxed by Bilal for the most part anyway. Waxed is a strong word. He got cleanly beaten, let's put it that way. So yeah, I have him at 7 as well.
Who did you have at 6?
So this is the last part where I struggled a little bit. Same. Okay, this is the last part. I've got Lawler at 6.
Same.
And the reason why he's at 6 is because you might want to put him a little bit higher depending on where you put Miletic. But to me, if you didn't really live through Pat Miletic's reign, it's kind of hard to understand. Like, Pat Miletic is the first guy to make welterweight welterweight. Like, mm-hmm. Welterweight is a thing because of the initial round of dominance that he offered. That's just the reality. And then the other part that kind of blows up Pat Miletic's reign, we'll talk about him in just a minute, is the fact that his protege ends up being one of the very best of all time.
Right.
So you know, you just like welterweight became a thing because of either Miletic or the Miletic camp. That's just a reality. Yeah. And Lawler, to that point, someone who initially came from that camp. Isn't that amazing that three of the top guys at welterweight basically are all from the one way or the other
as well.
It's insane to think about that. But I have Lawler at 6 because, dude, Mike, back me up on this. For folks who like only caught up with him once he came back to the UFC, and then he really hit his groove, starting from that Josh Koscheck fight all the way through, turning in some of the most incredible performances, the Carlos Condit fight, the Rory McDonald fight, and you know, obviously these are title performances as well. He was a bit of a fuck up. He was a bit of a fuck up before. He was always considered to be one of these guys coming out of that Miletic team. You're like, oh my God, when he like flatlined Tiki Gosen and stuff like that, you're like, holy shit, this guy's incredible. But then he got beat by Nick Diaz, which was a big upset at the time. He got triangled by Evan Tanner, which was a big upset at the time. And then he just kind of weaved his way through a little bit with Strikeforce and Icon Sport. And he was up, he was down. One time, Mike, we had him. I called fights for a local organization here called the UWC. This was in the like late 2009s or so, 2000s, I should say. And he was a guest, you know, because they always bring in fighters and it's like a meet and greet. Dude, he was supposed to be like you know, glad handing at the weigh-ins. He fell asleep at the weigh-ins in his chair. You know what I mean?
At a press conference on the dais.
Like, yeah, just not giving a fuck. He didn't give a fuck. But then something happened when he came back to the UFC and everything got dialed in. Now, he doesn't have enough of that for me to put him against what we're now talking about are the true heavy hitters. But he did do enough to put himself, I think, right next to it. Again, with some of these iconic performances, he is beloved for those reasons. So give me Lawler at 6.
Yeah, couldn't have said it much better. If we were making a list of most exciting welterweight champions of all time, he's probably number one. Ooh. So he gets his own, you know, touche there. And yeah, one of the most exciting things. And he, in a way, you know, we're talking about it earlier with Islam leaving lightweight. Like, there was that period where it felt the GSP hangover, right? And the Johnny Hendricks stuff was weird because we thought he should have beat him. But this guy comes in and he, I think, completely creates his own path, a completely different style. So exciting fight of the years, like every time. And yeah, he made a completely own legacy and I think allowed the welterweight division to completely forget about the GSP era. So yeah, big credit there. Lawler, yeah, had him at 6, rightfully deserved. But you kind of look at the guys above him, just, you know, double the title defenses at least. So hard to look past that. Number 5, I had Pat Miletich. Did you have him there as well?
I have Pat Miletich at 5. Why don't you tell me why and I'll see what I can echo.
Yeah, I mean, I think self-explanatory, like a little bit inaugural champion, put together 4 title defenses, set the tone for what greatness is in this weight class. Obviously, a completely different era as we spoke about, but you know, you got to give the Trailblazers their respect, especially when he had, you know, an actual title defense. If we did this for women's flyweight champion, I don't think Nico Montano is getting the same level of love, you know. But like, this is obviously one of the most rich, storied weight classes in the history of the UFC. So for him to kick it off, as you said, he also like has ties to some of the other greatest welterweights of all time. He's just he's got to be there.
I mean, the reason why I can't put him higher, even though he's got, you know, he's got the same number of title defenses as Tyron Woodley.
Yep.
But I don't think that the wins are quite as good, although they're pretty good. I mean, Jorge Patino Macaco, legendary trailblazer. Andre Pinheiros turned out to be one of the best coaches in MMA history, certainly out of Brazil, maybe the number one. The John Alessio win, Alessio was a good fighter, not a great one. And then Kenichi Yamamoto, a decent one, not a great one. So he's got some big names for the first two. The last two don't mean as much to me. And for that reason, I respect like what he did. As I mentioned, like the guy, to your point, like the way you put it, he set the tone at welterweight for its greatness. Like, just no question about it. But the strength of schedule to me, and I know people might have some questions about some of the other title defenses that other champions have, but to me, if we're just being very precise, to the extent possible, it's a amazing resume, but it falls a little bit short of a higher position due to some of the comparisons and strength of schedule.
Yeah, and you look at the guys above him. I mean, it's hard for me to put him over there. I debated having Lawler above him at 5, but I think if you asked Robbie Lawler, he would say, "Don't put me above this man." So we'll give him that respect.
Yeah, you could make a debate. Yeah, like, again, like, because what Lawler did in that UFC return, you could make an argument for it, but it's, dude, 4 title defenses, even in an early era, is tough. That's tough to do. So
for sure. Yeah. Okay. So number 4, I wonder if we'll continue to be lockstep here, but maybe a little bit of difference. I'll give you the floor. Who did you have up 4?
Tyron Woodley also has 4 title defenses. And I know what someone's going to say. It's like, yeah, well, one of those was Darren Till. Okay.
Well, and another one was a draw.
That's true. Yeah. But the problem was that draw was one of the fights of the year. It was an absolutely fucking incredible contest. So there's that. The second part I'm going to say there is, you know, Till was the best version of himself heading into that fight. You know, he kind of, Till's career has, as an elite MMA fighter, has kind of collapsed, but at that point he was still he was huge for the weight class as well. Mm-hmm. And it was the nature of how Tyron beat him, which I thought was very impressive. Also, not for nothing, he beat Robbie Lawler to get the title and he stopped him very quickly in the process. So for me, that's, you know, Pat Miletich beat Mikey Burnett. Not the same thing. Now, Robbie Lawler was coming off of the Carlos Condit fight, which was neither guy was the same after it, to that point. But nevertheless, you're just looking like, who did you beat to get up there? He beat Lawler, stopped him with strikes, and then goes on to do pretty impressive things over the course of almost 1,000 days. Yeah, he's number 4 on my list.
Yeah, easy one. I think my opinion as well. You nailed it. Number 3, maybe we might have difference at 3 and 2, or are we going to be the same all the way? I had Matt Hughes at number 3. Could have put him at two, but yeah, I think he's, you know, he's the one. He could be there. He was the standard of this division for so long, and most certainly the standard of number two forever, I thought, behind George St. Pierre. But as time goes on, you know, records are meant to be broken, and, you know, at one point, you know, it is still the standard, I guess, for second best with the five defenses. But yeah, what can you say? Like, Matt Hughes, legend, kind of got robbed of another title defense too when Joe Diesel Riggs missed weight for their fight, making a non-title bout. So like, he, there's a few tough ones on his resume where maybe, you know, instead of five title defenses, we're talking about seven, and he is at two. But I do think he got slowly surpassed over time. But whatever you think of Matt Hughes as a person, and I know a lot of people don't think much, but as a fighter, he was incredible, and one of the guys that, you know, when I first started watching the sport, was a dominant force and on top of it all. And yeah, he's got to be number three.
I mean, again, he's got the two different title reigns, right? Because he loses to Penn, and they got to figure it out. And then he beats St. Pierre. Now, that was St. Pierre's. That wasn't his debut.
I think it was his second UFC fight, and like seventh MMA fight.
Yeah. So I mean, if you actually have never seen it, I'm sure many of you have, but if you've never seen it, go look at the stare down. St. Pierre admitted later he was so nervous he couldn't look at him, and rather than looking down, he actually looks up. Rather than making eye, I've never seen that before. It makes no eye contact. I've seen, but not this. You know, it's kind of crazy. And he gets armbarred via a mistake, and then he goes on to beat Frank Trigg in the rematch, which was fucking incredible. And then BJ Penn, although BJ Penn, you know, I remember BJ Penn, they asked him, what are you going to do to train for the rematch? He's like, nothing. I'm going to go surfing. And it's like, okay, all right, BJ, what the fuck are we doing? Anyway, but here's the thing. For me at Matt, like Matt Hughes, like, you know, let's go through his wins here. Hayato Sakurai, y'all don't know who that is. One of the best Japanese fighters of all time, period. Mm-hmm. Carlos Newton, guy who's already on this list. Gil Castillo doesn't mean as much to me. It was a guy to the West Coast. I think our precursor scrap pack kind of guy. Sean Sherk, a very, very tough fight. And then Frank Trigg was a very, very tough fight. And then he has another one against Frank Trigg. And then ultimately he gets the revenge on BJ in two different title reigns. But the thing you have to really keep in mind is, Matt Hughes was a two-time All-American in college in Division I wrestling, which at the time, yeah, you'd seen guys like Couture and Lin and whatever. But in the smaller weight classes, you'd never seen a folk-style guy just have absolute physical and technical dominance in the way that he had on the floor. He was something of a marvel in that way. And he represented, you could tell from, because he was part of that Miletic camp, you could see the difference from like welterweight under Miletic to now welterweight under Hughes. He was the standard bearer of excellence in MMA at that time. One of the key figures for UFC that they wanted to build around. And just for to see what it looked like for a Division I multiple time All-American to go and then just thrash these guys was a sight to behold, which of course makes what St. Pierre ultimately did to him later such an important victory. But you know, this is an incredible career you're talking about here, even from an era that, you know, a lot of fans may not have seen his fights. But believe you me, dude, this guy showed what it like. Why is it so important to get, you know, really good wrestlers out of college? Matt Hughes was one of the ones that made this abundantly clear to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And again, probably got cut short of a couple title defenses. The Joe Riggs thing, he did a side quest with Hoist Gracie at one point there. So yeah, there's a few things where if, you know, it was steady, but that goes to show how much the UFC valued him, kind of putting him in those spots. I assume we have the same number two being one Kamaru Usman and his five title defenses. Obviously, you know, the debate was him or Hughes for number two, and I think he did surpass that with his work as the champion and, you know, one of the greatest title reigns in UFC history. We alluded to it earlier, one of seven guys to have three title defenses in a year. Some huge rivalries, some huge fights, massive moments in time, being on the first card back from COVID on Fight Island there. So like, he's got a lot of layers to this legacy here.
And he beat Tyron Woodley thoroughly to claim the title. So he beat another guy who's in top four basically on this list in order to be able to do it.
Yep.
And to the point you raised, I mean, the reason why to me he goes above Hughes is, although a guy like Kamaru really isn't possible without a Hughes, to be honest, the truth is, you know, it's not like it's not like Hughes was fighting scrubs. He was fighting good guys, but he did lose right in the middle of his title reign to a guy who came up and, you know, whose training was surfing. Granted, sure. Granted, Penn is, you know, at that point in time was, you know, an otherworldly figure, but still it was like a big blemish. To me, what really makes Kamaru and then ultimately GSP stand out in all this is unending excellence for a long stretch of time. And I did an interview one time. Were you at Jones? Who did he fight in Atlanta? Jones, Rashad. Were you there for that one?
I was not.
So I interviewed Matt Brown one time. It's one of these interviews that really, sometimes you interview guys. Matt Brown was supposed to fight, I don't know, some Canadian guy, I forget his name. And he was fighting Wonder Boy. He was fighting Wonder Boy. And I asked Matt Brown, like, what do you make of his kickboxing career? And he was like, well, I don't really know what point fighting karate is supposed to mean. But he made a point to me, which was, but, you know, the guy had something like 50 or however many like wins in a row, right, in kickboxing. He's like, the thing you have to think about is how many times did he show up injured? How many times did he show up sick? How many times did he show up not wanting to be there or distracted or having an off day? And he still managed to find a way to win. And to me, like I'll never forget that interview. Like, it just sat with me for a long time. Mm-hmm. So for Kamaru to go basically 1,300 days on a title reign against top rivals who could match his skills in certain respects, Colby Covington obviously never got over the hump, but, you know, was a worthy adversary, I think is probably the right way to put it. And he just was unflinching up until that head kick against Leon. That's a big fucking deal, man. That is so tough to do. He, to me, is the clear consensus, or should be the consensus, number two. And what he put together is really special.
Agreed. And did it with no knees, apparently. So yeah. You get big bonus points for that. Clearly, like, you know, a guy who, in a way, did start later after, you know, accruing a lot of damage and stuff like that. So, yeah, I could not have said it better myself. Kamaru Usman, easily number two. And you wonder if he didn't take that head kick, where would we be talking about him now, or what kind of guys would he have beaten after the fact? Who knows? But yeah, one of the legends of the sport. And of course, that leads to the ultimate legend of the sport, arguably not only the greatest welterweight of all time, but maybe the greatest fighter of all time, George St. Pierre. This was an obvious layup. You know, we could, I guess, dock him some points for succumbing to Matt Serra the way he did, but he showed, you know, that was a banana peel type moment and dominated him in the second fight, and then, you know, went on one of the great reigns in UFC history. So, yeah, I think the only blemishes, I guess, for GSP, and tell me if you feel differently, the Matt Serra fight and then the way the Johnny Hendricks fight ended. But, you know, he still got his hand raised, and here we are. He came back and won a second belt, too.
Yeah, I mean, again, his run is not flawless for that reason. It's got some things you can nitpick, but
everyone's does.
Yeah. But dude, GSP's run, if you live through it, they're like, I remember during Kamaru's run, people were like, oh, is this on par with GSP? And not to diminish it, it's like an amazing run. I never felt it was close. Like, I watched what St. Pierre meant to the game and like what he was doing. And you have to understand something too, for a guy with no wrestling background at all, you take it for granted now, but at the time, this was a fucking monster achievement. You know, to go and be able to out-wrestle John Fitch, to go be able to out-wrestle, to the extent he needed to, Josh Koscheck. This was, you're like, a Canadian French-speaking guy is out-wrestling Division I national champions? And the answer is yes. Like, it was unbelievable. His athleticism was so clearly ahead of everybody else. Dude, he didn't just dominate the game. He forced the rest of the game to level up. Right. So it's one thing to like have a long win streak against very, very good guys. It's another one to like you're so clearly better than everyone that if anyone has any hope of like trying to live up to the next standard of what the game is going to be, you got to match what he's doing. You got to figure out what that is, and you got to just understand it in all the parts. And even when he changed his style, he was a little bit more striking friendly early on and then wrestle heavy later. Mm-hmm. He still couldn't be touched. He still had excellent jiu-jitsu. He still, you know, had so many different tools in the tool belt and had this, again, the length of the dominance was, in terms of the title reign, was just next level. But and then also on a separate thing, which is not really relevant to this conversation, but to watch like Gatorade come after him and then Under Armour, again, things you're like, holy shit, I didn't know an MMA fighter could do that. St. Pierre did all of that. He was so... How many times in your life when you're watching, you're not watching a good fighter or even a great one or even an elite one. You're watching one clearly ahead of his time. That does not happen very, very often. I can count on my hand the number of times I've seen that. St. Pierre is far and away that guy. Like maybe you could say Anderson had a better UFC title run, or you could pick whoever you want. But for me, Mike, I watched him and I was like, dude, this guy is from the future. He's from the future. And that just doesn't happen very often. Number one, easily the best welterweight ever.
Totally agree. As I said, one of the best fighters ever, the way he would, you know, beat you at your best. It's him and Jon Jones that kind of would do that. Be like, you know, the way you think you can beat me, I'm going to beat you that way. And he did that multiple times over. And yeah, it was just so impressive. And as you said, they're amazing ambassador for the sport. One of the first guys who showed up in the suits and all that stuff, and was an exceptional fighter as well. And, you know, nicest guy you could ever meet. No controversies really. So like it was, you know, it's going to be hard for anyone to beat this. You look at like all the divisional goats. I'm like, man, he might be, him and Jones are probably the toughest two to even get close to. And you look at this list, there's no one that's going to come close now. But I guess that leads into it. And, you know, as I guess we wrap up the things, we were pretty much in lockstep most of the way besides those like first five or so. And rightfully so, I think this was the right way to go for the list. But as we look to the future here, Luke, you know, we talked a lot about Jack Della Maddalena, Islam Makhachev. If you had to make the guess when Jack's reign comes to an end, where is he going to fit on this list? Is he going to be in, you know, the 1-7 range, or is he going to be in that 8-13? I guess it'll be
8-13. I mean, here's the interesting part to me about welterweight, which is, as I mentioned, all those guys that we've been talking about, I think are so great, but none of them appear to be the transcendent figure in the sport. None of them appear to my mind to be the guy you're like, oh my God, like, you know, what is possible here? To me, I feel like, someone else made this point to me, so I'm stealing someone else's point. I forget who told me this, but they compared it to the light heavyweight division before Jon Jones got there, where, yeah, you know, guys might have it for a couple, but it's just hot potato all the time. And by the way, that's pretty exciting. That's not a bad thing at all. I just don't see them as like they're gonna run, you know, for the next 4 years undefeated. That just seems impossible for me to believe. But we shall see. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's going to be a tough one. I mean, if you said his first title defense was going to be Ian Garry or Shavkat, not freaking Islam Makhachev, we might be having a different story. But if he beats Islam, man, like he's shot himself right up there. I mean, I probably put him in that like top seven right away. So
you beat the number one pound for pound guy in the sport, you're gonna end up on high on some lists for sure.
Yeah, and especially because Bilal was what, like in top seven or something pound for pound coming in, so it would be a big deal for Jack. But it's a tremendous uphill climb. Before I let you go here, Luke, I guess since we to wrap up this whole welterweight conversation, seems like we are getting Jack Della Maddalena versus Islam Makhachev late this year. There's a lot of other guys in this division who feel they deserve a title shot that are probably going to have to fight one now. What are the fights that you think make sense between, you know, like Sean Brady, Ian Garry, Shavkat, Colby Covington, Bilal Muhammad, you know, Leon Edwards? There's a lot of these guys out there. Is there a couple fights among that bunch you really want to see, or one that you think would be the best title eliminator to face the winner?
I would love to see Sean Brady, Ian Garry. Yeah. I've talked to Sean Brady privately, and he's even expressed this publicly. I'm not like sharing anything yet, anybody doesn't know. He really wants that fight. He really wants that fight. And I think it'd be a good test, because what really to me is a big difference between the two is Brady is probably not as well-rounded overall as Ian Garry, but he is much more skilled to me on the mat and is a much better finisher for that reason, or at least has the capability of being a much better like it was. Ian Garry can get to good positions and has like really missing finishing mechanics. Sean Brady does not have his are awesome. That would be a fun one to see, honestly. Beyond that, I would like, I mean, dude, Shavkat versus any of those Bubbas is fucking awesome, please don't misunderstand me, but I think Buckley is probably going to polish off Usman just to the state that things are. Mm-hmm. Buckley versus Shavkat would not be my first choice. And I know Shavkat's kind of owed one, but that would be fun. But the one I really want to see is Shavkat Islam. That is the one that I want to see. So Ian Garry, Brady, and then Islam and Shavkat. Those are the two big ones.
Okay, yeah, the ones I had, Sean Brady versus Shavkat, I thought made sense. Obviously, Usman and Buckley is happening. Maybe Bilal Muhammad gets the whoever, whether it's Usman wins or loses. I think you have to do that fight after their podcast drama. If not with Bilal, I think Bilal and Colby Covington probably make sense. There's some heat there.
Yep.
Would Colby take that fight? I don't know, but I think if you're Colby, like, if they give you the number one guy, that's a great way to put yourself right back in there, right? It makes up for it all. And then I guess that would leave Ian Garry versus Leon Edwards. Like, give me that as a fight night main event in London next time they go or something.
Not bad.
Like, that kind of makes sense. And if Buckley wins, I think you could also do Garry versus Buckley. There's some story there. They're supposed
Buck
to
Buck versus Cuck.
Yes, exactly. It is already building. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting. Obviously, crazy times for welterweight right now. So,
man, I'm loving it. Because, dude, the thing that's been missing at lightweight, and now it's starting to happen a little bit more. Ilya's there, and so
turnover.
There. The turnover. There just wasn't enough turnover. And it's not like we didn't like seeing Dustin win or Justin win. It's not the point. But, like, a division that's kind of supposed to turn over a little bit on a natural order. Well, you're getting all of that at 170, and I think that's just a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, I love that. That's a very good point. Like, especially if the way some of these fights shake out, you know, that whole era is going to be gone. Okay, Luke, I appreciate you joining me for so long here. This has been a lot of fun. Anything you want to plug before I let you get out here?
YouTube.com/Luke Thomas. Subscribe. Enjoy.
All right. Keep kicking ass, Luke. Hopefully we'll do this again. Appreciate you joining for the rankings. I will take a quick break and be right back to wrap things up. That does it for another edition of the Bonfire Podcast. Thank you so much to Luke for joining the show once again. And another rankings extravaganza. Those exercises are a lot of fun. Curious to know what you thought about our list. Does it compare? Are we off? Are we in lockstep? Me and Luke were pretty similarly minded along the way there, but a couple differences. So curious to know what you thought about that. Leave a comment. Any other questions about today's show or any of the latest news, I can try to respond to those in the comments as well if you're leaving them on the YouTube channel. And of course, you can hit me up on any of my social medias at Mike Bond on X, at Mike Bond MMA on Instagram. Appreciate my man Kamikaze Abby Subban for producing the show as always. And until next week, we will see you back here by the Bonfire.